were to summarize briefly what we tried to do this morning, I could do it in two statements as follows. Lutherans recognize the existence of government as God's gift to his fallen creatures to make life in community possible, even when such a government is a poor government. Number two, that in an open society like ours, we have the privilege and responsibility to work for the maintenance and improvement of government as individuals and as a church body, the church body being an association before the law, a voluntary association. On this last point, let me repeat that in a free society, the community is above the state. America is a community of communities. It is that type of government where the communities decide what the limits of authority are in government and what directions it is to take in the carrying out of its job. We move on this afternoon to a discussion of the morality of warfare. Before we go into the details, let me read Article 16 from the Augsburg Confession, which is entitled Of Civil Affairs. Of civil affairs, they teach that lawful civil ordinances are good works of God, and that it is right for Christians to bear civil office, to sit as judges, to judge matters by the imperial decree and other existing laws, to award just punishments, to engage in just wars, jurabiliare is the Latin for this, to serve as soldiers, to make legal contracts, to hold property, to take an oath when required by the magistrates, to marry a wife, I like the inclusion of this, to be given in marriage. I have read this primarily because this is a particularly Lutheran approach, and our theology is unlike what goes on in much of contemporary Protestant theology and also in Roman Catholic theology. Having said that by way of preface, let us go on with the subject. We live in a world that has gone completely mad. We spend $200 billion a year on armaments. When the peace conference began in 1960 in Geneva, the costs for armaments in the world were one-tenth of what they are in 1972. Will you therefore look on page 7 in your document from the Commission on Theology, because there is a significant paragraph. It is 7 on page 7. The destructive potential of modern weaponry and the impersonality of contemporary techniques of warfare lay upon the Christian citizen the special burden of reminding himself and others that human life is a sacred trust from man's creator, and that the temptation to rely on and resort to the kind of massive violence made possible by these inventions has introduced into the human situation a new factor of incalculable moral magnitude. It is therefore imperative for him to work together with all men of goodwill for the responsible limitation of armaments, the eradication of sources of conflict, and an aggressive interest in the preservation and expansion of the conditions of peace. The difficulty with this paragraph, of course, is that it is so hard for individual citizens to get to those levers of power which could possibly change the mad course on which the world has chosen to move. President Nixon's visits to Peking and Moscow are a contribution to this general sort of thing. But when you're dealing of nations as they relate to other nations, there are complications, there are demonic factors involved, which upset the best calculations of men. What the immediate future holds, therefore, probably, is not a nuclear holocaust, but a series of wars of liberation. And we will continue to live in a world held at peace reasonably by the balance of terror. Now, in that kind of situation, what shall we say about the morality of warfare? What I have to say will be brought to you under three major headings, three principles: the principle of complexity, the principle of discrimination, and the principle of proportion. And I will indicate as we go through each principle what the sub-points are. And what I'm doing is reorganizing the materials in your document. I'll point to the respective paragraphs when we get there. First of all, then, the principle of complexity. The pacifist oversimplifies life. I remember speaking to one some years ago and said I was going to talk on the ethics of warfare, and he said, well, that should be a very short speech. There is a sense in which he is dead right. There is a sense in which war is immoral at all times. However, there is another sense in which war may be less of an evil than not resorting to arms, and therefore becomes right. It so happens, and this is the first subpoint under that principle of complexity, that in life we rarely get the opportunity of making a clean choice between black and white. Most options come to us in the area of gray. And we have the job of trying to decide what choice is less gray than some other one. Ethically speaking, the choice of the lesser evil is the right one. The syllogism which the pacifist uses goes like this: all war is evil. No one ought to engage in evil, therefore I cannot participate in war. That sounds airtight logically, but may I call your attention to the fact that the definition of evil changes in the minor syllogism from the major one. The major premise assumes evil to be an absolute, while the minor premise talks about it in realistic, workable terms. In point of fact, a resort to arms may be less evil than some other course of action. It would have been evil, a great evil, for America not to have taken up arms, for example, against the Nazis. Here was a conspiracy against the freedoms and the dignity of men everywhere. The choice of not going to arms would have been more wrong than taking up arms as we did in World War II. Now, we don't have much of a problem in that particular area. The problem of warfare and its morality has come up later, specifically in connection with the Vietnam conflict. And maybe it's good to say at this point that this is probably the major contribution that conflict will have made to our history and to our thought. It will have raised the question of ethics and morality to a very high degree. Next subpoint under the principle of complexity. There is abroad among Americans the utopian notion that there must be something wrong about a government which has to resort to arms. Now, this dream is utopian because it assumes that people always act rationally, that negotiation will never fail, If it is said, therefore, that a government must succeed in negotiation or be replaced by one that can, this may be a utopian dream because nations in particular, being troubled by this demonic force of political power, have great difficulty remaining rational when it comes to problems of their own national security. And so war is a kind of parable of our total existence. It is a reminder that we live in a sinful, fallen world where things can run out of control because men do not always use sweet reasonableness. The third subpoint. The question of warfare comes to us as a problem in conscience, especially when it comes to the point of engaging in combat. We need to remind ourselves that this is part of our Judeo-Christian heritage and is one of the blessings that we have in our culture. As a question in conscience, war did not bother a man like Genghis Khan. It does not bother Brezhnev, especially when it is a war of liberation. For us, it is a question in conscience, and we owe that, first of all, to the Jews of the second century BC. They raised this question as a problem in conscience at that time. This is somewhat remarkable because, as you know, the Old Testament is full of all kinds of stories of wars, the destruction of whole cities, men, women, and children. But after the exile, particularly when it regained its own political independence, the Jews began to discuss the problem of warfare in terms of conscience. From there, it spilled over into the early church. And interestingly enough, it was not always just the commandment, "Thou shalt not kill," which was discussed by the church fathers in that early setting. It was also the first commandment, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." For when you entered the Roman army and you took your oath of office, you were expected to burn a pinch of incense to the statue of Caesar, and this was considered to be idolatrous. Therefore, a man like Tertullian would say, and did say, that a Christian cannot be a soldier because it is in violation of the first commandment. Now, the fifth commandment also got some discussion. We'll come back to that point very shortly. When the church finally began to be a permitted operation, then when it began to be the established religion, it had a completely different relationship to government, and at last had some responsibility for the direction of government, and had to help carry the burdens of society. The Roman commander of troops in North Africa in the days of St. Augustine was a Christian, Boniface by name. At one point, he decided what many another officer does in the military establishment ever since. He decided to get out of the service to do more spiritual work, that's what he called it, by becoming a priest. Before doing so, however, he wrote to Bishop Augustine and asked him for his judgment. The bishop wrote a very interesting letter, which we still have today, in which he suggested to Count Boniface that the best spiritual work he could do is to remain in the service and continue to be the commander of Roman troops in order to protect North Africa against the Vandals. He closed that letter with a remarkable sentence, namely, "We must not before the time live with saints alone." This was his recognition that history is a messy business, and that you do not come to issues clean as a rule, but have a choice to make between what is less gray and more gray. Under the impact of the Judeo-Christian tradition, the Church of the Middle Ages devised various instruments of control. It set aside from Saturday evening until Monday morning as a time to keep the peace of God it was called. And as the number of holidays increased, about one third of the church year was not open for warfare. Well, you can imagine what happened during the open season. The conflict just got more rough than it might have been otherwise. There was the truce of God, which limited the number of people legitimately engaged in a given conflict. From there, we jump to the Geneva Convention of 1864 as another example of how our values and our culture are affected by the Judeo-Christian tradition. In 1864, it was decided that medics should be considered as non-combatants, that the wounded of all sides should be treated humanely, and that any civilians engaged in the service of the wounded should be treated as neutrals. Now, one significant item appears here: the distinction between combatant and non-combatant, which has become a very significant item in contemporary ethics. For a combatant soldier is not just an individual, just as the President of the United States is not just Richard Mealhouse Nixon. He is the President of the United States, and therefore occupies an office with certain responsibilities he is expected to carry out under legitimate authority. So a combatant in warfare is not just an individual who happens to be at that particular place in the line of fire. He is an individual who, under legitimate authority and orders, has a job to do. As Paul Ramsey puts it in his great book on the Just War, the object of combat is the incapacitation of the combatant from doing what he is doing because he is that particular combatant in that particular war. It is not the killing of a man because he is that particular man. There are efforts at the present time, as you have read, by a committee of the International Red Cross to persuade the representatives of various nations to conduct war more humanely. And this has come up because of the B-52 operation, because of the electronics devices that have been introduced into the conflict in Southeast Asia. We have also developed the doctrine of limited warfare. This is a decision by President Kennedy back in 1961. Ever since that time, the Department of Defense operates on the two principles of controlled response and conventional option, because warfare is to us a problem in conscience. And I've cited these items to indicate that there is a sense in which right still plays an important part in the affairs of nations. I've discussed this under the principle of complexity because all of these items with further details have to be considered in any evaluation of a particular hostile action or campaign. The next is the principle of discrimination. It consists of discriminating and deciding for a war what the issues are. What is the contest all about? For the contemporary situation, and I'm not talking about South Vietnam specifically, for the contemporary situation in which the United States finds itself, the issue is that of freedom. This has usually been our burden. because the founding fathers of this nation operated on a given philosophy, namely, that the ills of men can be ameliorated if you will give them a certain amount of freedom. Now, they understood freedom in a certain way. And that's significant today because there are three notions of liberty which are contending for the hearts and minds of men today. The first of is the notion that freedom is my right to do as I jolly well please. Well, that's not freedom at all. That's license. That is just as destructive as the waters of a river getting out of their bed. As long as that water is under control, it can be harnessed and produce something constructive. As soon as its waters overflow the banks, as witness Rapid City, South Dakota, you have nothing but destruction. License is destruction. It is freedom run amok. There's another view of liberty. It is the totalitarian definition that freedom is my responsibility to do what I must do. How do I know what I must do? The party tells me. That's its job. And I have the choice of either doing what the party tells me or suffering the consequences. The function of the party in a Marxist state is to analyze the historical situation and to prescribe what needs to be done at that particular moment. You will recall I talked about this Jewish Lutheran pastor from Romania with whom I used to drink cappuccinos in the afternoon. That's an interesting Italian word, by the way. It's the word for a Capuchin monk. If you mix water and milk, it gets a brown color, the color of a Capuchin habit. If you put a little whipped cream on it, it looks like an old Capuchin monk. That's how it gets to be called a cappuccino. Well, one afternoon, we were drinking another cappuccino, and he gave me a little yardstick as to how to understand and interpret what goes on in a totalitarian society. He said, imagine yourself being in a country where everything not specifically commanded is prohibited. That's where we live in Romania, he said. Is it any wonder that life is so gray and dull behind the Iron Curtain? Because one does things on his own at great risk. Unless there is a decree or a law to support you, the action is prohibited. That's the totalitarian notion of freedom. Our country has always operated on a third notion of freedom, which owes a great deal to the Judeo-Christian tradition by way of the deists who founded our country. Liberty is my opportunity to do what I ought to do. That's the way we talk about it. And there are two things in this statement which are of frightful significance. First of all, I am assuming that there is an ought. It is my presupposition, your presupposition, that there is a set of moral principles which is valid, regardless of the historical situation and circumstance in which we live. This is our major contest with Marxism on the moral level. For Lenin was quite explicit when he said, we deny that there is such a thing as a moral law independent of the historical process, apart from the social situation. It is a fraud. We devise our own moral principles according to the needs of the class struggle. I don't know how this could be said more bluntly and straightly. There has to be an ought to provide the Archimedean point we talked about this morning, to which one can appeal beyond the laws. Secondly, if freedom is my opportunity to do what I ought to do, I am implying that God created us with the faculty of choice. Now, I'm not talking about free will now. Free will is a special theological concept that has to do with our relationship to God in terms of redemption. We have no free will in that sense. But we have all kinds of opportunities and various faculties in order to choose the everyday projects that we have in hand. This is what makes us persons, the faculty of choice and the opportunity to do the choosing. And so freedom becomes less a political question than a theological one. For freedom is rooted in the nature, the need, and destiny of man. Let's look first of all at his nature. He is not a thing. When a bar of gold sinks to the bottom of the ocean, it is without value because it is without use. We do not treat a human being that way. We spend millions, even billions of dollars every year to take care of people who are of absolutely no use to society. But they are persons. By nature, they are creatures and children of God. Freedom is related to the need of man. You can't grow a big oak tree in a 2-gallon pail. Either the pail will burst or the tree will wither. East Germany tries to hold tight to 2-gallon pail. With 100,000 policemen, dogs, mines, tanks, barbed wire, the wall in Berlin. And what happens is that people become less than persons. The finest commentary on that I know about is by Fyodor Dostoevsky, the Russian, who was sent to Siberia once because he was caught in a plot on the Tsar. He wrote about his life there. He had no choices to make. Nobody did. They ate the breakfast that was put before them, went out to fell trees that other people had marked. They came back as ordered and went to bed when prescribed. There wasn't a single choice to make, and the title of the book is The House of the Dead. Of course these people walked around and felled a few trees yet while they were living, but for all practical purposes, as persons, they were dead. Furthermore, freedom is related to the destiny of men. If I live to be 70, 80 years old, and that's the end of the story, then, of course, the state is more important because it outlasts me. But if I have an eternal destiny, as you and I believe, then no government is more important than myself. That's why Jefferson could talk about unalienable rights that we have as persons, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We are not just things. To be persons, we need room for choice, and our destiny lies beyond the here and now. Now, the prophets of our day, who are like the prophets of the Old Testament, sounding off on this particular issue and reminding us that this is the item at stake, are Russian artists and writers. They are telling us that this is, by all odds, the most important issue that confronts the last half of the 20th century. You have people like Solzhenitsyn telling us that, Vasily Grossman, or let me take Eugenie Evtushenko. He's been here twice in America. The first time in 1966, he also got to Alaska. By the way, as an honorary Texas citizen, I have a right to make sassy remarks about Alaska. It's bigger than Texas, though. He got to Alaska, saw the Blue Fox Farms, and then went back to write a monologue of the Blue Fox on an Alaskan animal farm. This is the most devastating satire on the totalitarian notion of freedom that one can imagine. It's the story of a fox, a blue fox, who doesn't appreciate the possibility and the probability of being skinned and then having his fur sold on the New York market. So he shrieks either for a change in fur or freedom. Well, one night, the gate to his cage is open, and he goes out to sample freedom. But in a couple of weeks, he discovers that freedom comes with a burden. You have to make up your own mind. And this gets to be so troublesome for him that he finally decides to go back to his cage. And the monologue concludes with the statement that a child born in captivity is too weak for freedom. And I mention this because in a totalitarian society today, and this is the only time this has ever been possible in history, with the instruments for manipulating whole societies and the medicine to take people's souls apart and putting them back together again, it is possible to take whole societies and reduce them to the level of an anthill type of existence, at which point they no longer want their freedom. There's a play by Eugenie Schwartz of East Germany called The Dragon on that point. It's a simple fairy tale. The tale is about a country that has been under the control of a dragon for years, and a knight comes dashing across the stage to liberate the country. But he discovers that these people don't want to be set free. They don't want this burden of having to make their own decisions. In our society, with our notion of freedom, we have this burden. The other side of the burden is that this is what keeps people as persons. Under the principle of discrimination, then, the first subpoint is that we decide what the issue is. If freedom is that important, as I've tried to make it, then warfare may at times be a good choice if it involves the issue of freedom. Next, justice and love. Here will you turn to your document, paragraphs 5 and 6. We hear it said, and properly so, that we ought to love our neighbor as ourselves. Now, that's a good summary of the second table of the law. But the implementation of it is not always that simple. For example, if a thug enters my living room and threatens my family, I have a prior responsibility, ethically speaking, to my family than to the thug. The distribution of love according to various responsibilities and priorities is what we call justice. You cannot possibly in life practice love on the same level with everybody with whom you are in contact because the relationships and priorities differ. In that light, let's consider 5 and 6. The one-to-one relationship between individuals is changed during hostilities by the interposition of a set of divergent loyalties on the part of persons opposing each other in combat. This is the difference between combatants and individuals. Under these conditions, a hierarchy of relationships is created, requiring the application of justice to the practice of love. 6. Christian love expects the one-to-one relationship of individual to individual to return and to be applied even during times of hostility in a personal confrontation with an enemy who is wounded or is in need of some other personal service. And that was written into the Geneva Convention of 1864, and on that basis. The third item under the principle of discrimination is the matter of fixed responsibility. The President of the United States, for example, has certain responsibilities under Article 2 of the Constitution. And ethically speaking, the presumption of right is on his side until it can be demonstrated that he is wrong. This is an old ethical principle devised to hold society together, namely that the presumption of right is on the side of the person who's got a job to do. Now, why do I make a point of this? Because we hear a lot of people on campuses particularly saying, but the president or Congress have the job to show me that it's right. They have the responsibility to make it very sure to me that a certain course of action is proper. That's inverting the relationship. No society can endure for very long with this upside-down approach to responsibility. So much for the principle of discrimination. The next is the principle of proportion. And here I want to start with an item on which there is a great deal of confusion today. Ever since 1964, we've heard some very strange talk in our country which suggests that any application of force is per se wrong. As a matter of fact, in any society, under any government, there has to be the controlled application of force at certain junctures because some problems don't yield themselves to any other kind of solution. Let me give you an example. Under President Eisenhower, we had the problem of school desegregation in Little Rock, Arkansas. There seemed to be no solution to that problem, finally, except sending in the paratroopers from Fort Campbell. Fortunately, it was solved without bloodshed, but it would not have been solved without the controlled application of force. Now, that was inside our country. The greatest number of questions arises outside. And here, of course, we're handicapped because we live in what we call the multi-state system, which began in 1648. The multi-state system divides the world into 141 sovereign nations, each one busy all the time trying to improve its relationship toward others in terms of power. In that kind of world, there are bound to be junctures where problems develop that cannot possibly be solved in any other way than by the controlled application of force. And that may be, and usually is, a good thing, ethically speaking. It is the business of the military to apply controlled force to such social problems that do not yield to other solutions. It is also the responsibility of the police forces within a country to apply controlled force. This is part of the question of the morality of warfare. For there may come a moment in the controlled application of force that runs out of control, and two nations are at war. Next, under the principle of proportion, you have to consider the whole issue of the just war. In your document on the last page, I give you the seven questions which have gone into the discussion of this issue. Is a war, this is under paragraph six, is a war being fought under legitimate authority? Is it being conducted within the framework of international agreements? Is it being waged in the interest of vindicating some obvious right that has suffered outrage? Have all peaceful means of achieving a settlement been exhausted? Is the destruction incurred excessive in terms of the goals to be achieved? Is it being waged with good intentions, or has it been undertaken for purposes of aggression? Will the results achieved by engaging in hostilities provide greater opportunity for justice and freedom to prevail than if such a war had not been entered into? Recently, the principle of proportionality has been proposed by the Roman Catholic bishops and by the Pope in Rome. as an additional principle. These seven come out of the history of the church, three of them from St. Augustine, three more from Thomas. They were part of the conceptualization in the days when the Lutheran confessions were written, and they speak of engaging in just wars, jure belare. Under the principle of proportion, let's consider very quickly the fifth commandment. That's paragraphs 3 and 4 on page 8 in your document. No, I'm sorry, it's page 7. Page 7 in your document. The responsibility of taking arms against other human beings, either as part of a police force or of a military establishment, is to be carried out without hatred of one's fellow men. For such animosity and anger constitute the most serious violations of the commandment, and the reference is to the Sermon on the Mount. Now the next. The word used in this commandment for killing is one that implies malice and hatred. It is nowhere used in the Old Testament for taking life in battle. There are 6 words, by the way, in the Old Testament for killing. This would suggest that the tragic task of taking up arms for combat under orders from legitimate authority is not by itself a violation of the fifth commandment. For strictly speaking, we ought to translate the commandment, the fifth commandment, as the RSV does in certain places, as thou shalt do no murder. Under the principle of proportion, finally, we have to consider the individual destiny and responsibility of a nation. In Acts 17, Paul tells us in his Areopagus speech that God determines the boundaries and the times of nations. What is the destiny and responsibility of the United States in the 20th century? It happens to be the only country with enough resources to be able to hold open the future for millions of men who are still dreaming about freedom. They would like to have the kind of liberties that we have in America. God does not, therefore, expect us to stand for peace at any price, but to work for righteousness at all costs.